K-Mud Podcast presents.
Welcome to Mindful Mud. I'm Fluvina, your host. I'm a Zen teacher, mindfulness instructor, and I'm truly grateful to be here on KMUD. And I'm actually super excited just to do this program today. This is Mindful Mud, and this show is about all kinds of different ways we can apply mindfulness into our real life. And today I am so honored to have Rhonda V. McGee as my guest. Rhonda McGee is a professor of law and founding director of the Center for Contemplative Law and Ethics at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Professor McGee is a mindfulness teacher and a prolific author who has spent more than 20 years exploring the intersections of anti-racist education, social justice, and contemplative practices, garnering international acclaim for her work. She's the author of the award-winning book, The Inner Work of Racial Justice, Healing Ourselves and Transforming Our Communities Through Mindfulness. Welcome, Rhonda.
Thank you so very much, my dear Fluvina. It's good to be with you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for joining us today, for sure. So, you know, I'm really inspired by your work, Rhonda. I mean, you're giving it so much. And you just, as we heard on the song, I really, like, you show up at the table again and again and just don't shy back from this very complicated, you know, the complicated issues and topics of race, racism. And I have to be very honest, you know, for me, This is not difficult to talk about. This is not easy to talk about. And I think I'm not alone, right? It's like, this is really hard. And I'm going to be just very open here. It's not a topic that I talk a lot, unfortunately. And I'm realizing this, like, it's not in my face every day, you know? And it's like, I'm realizing this more and more. It's like, wow. So I'm very shaky here talking about this, and this is why I'm even more excited to really have you here to explore it. And how can we talk about race, racism, social justice, racial justice, all these topics? So yes, so grateful for you. Grappling with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, can I just say how much I appreciate that kind introduction and the genuineness of your share right here at the outset about your own challenges in turning toward rather than away from this issue, or, you know, kind of opening up to a conversation about it. And, you know, what you're pointing to really in a certain sense is exactly why I wrote the book, The Inner Work of Racial Justice. You know, my own experience talking with folks about these issues over many years as a law professor and in and outside of classrooms in the world. I live in San Francisco. I travel a lot. I'm originally from the South. All of these experiences for me have revealed how hard it is for a lot of people to talk about this topic. And it invited me to explore how mindfulness can be a support. So before we go any further, if you're willing, I'd like to just offer us just a few moments of pausing.
Please.
Mm-hmm. And grounding ourselves as a support for our conversation. Would that be okay, my dear Fleury?
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Rhonda.
Great. Thank you. So again, this is just a very informal way of tapping into the resources we are pointing to when we use the word mindfulness, which I tend to think of as really a way of inviting us to reconnect with the innate ability we all have as human beings to relax into who we really are when we kind of let go a little bit more. I mean, and I recognize living in a social realm, we're always, you know, going to be challenged to fully let go. But really the idea is to let go a little bit of kind of the tensions around who we believe we need to be in the world and open up a little bit more to who we already are. So often using the practices of mindfulness, of breathing and bringing attention to this particular breath. So allowing our attention to rest on the sensations of breathing. Right here, right now, picking up on in-breath or the out-breath, wherever we happen to find ourselves right now. And just giving ourselves a moment to check in, to shift, if we're willing, the gaze that is so often externally directed, to allow a little bit of extra support for where we are right now. And I often add that we are bringing a kind of a quality of kindness, self-care, love right in to support us. And we can, from that place of bringing kind awareness to this particular breath, in or out, and then opening up that awareness to this whole body, noticing points of contact between body and chair, beneath that, the floor, and just breathing in and out and coming home to all of the natural resources that we have and that we are. And we notice when we do so, taking a conscious breath can just give us a little bit of spacious ability to restore and reconnect with our inner capacity for down-regulating when we're getting anxious, for just restoring that connection between those natural, you know, the breath, the lungs, the inner and to outer resources we have for being well with the challenges that we face in the world. So thank you for allowing us this moment of grounding.
Thank you, Rhonda. That was a wonderful moment of just, yeah, what does it mean to just give us a moment of mindfulness and tuning in? Mm-hmm. Takes a lot of groundedness, right, to actually grapple with these topics. So it's, I feel like, and you're writing this so wonderfully in the book, you're interspersing these mindfulness practices because they're so needed, right? When we go out on a limb and talk about these things where we all get like very shooken up often, right? And insecure and whatever comes with it. Yeah. So really, really, it's an incredible book. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So, yeah, what inspired you to actually write it?
Well, what really inspired me to write it was the work that I had been doing, you know, both in these formal classes that I've been teaching, you know, as mentioned, I've been a law professor for some couple decades now.
Wow.
at the University of San Francisco. And just exploring with students in those classrooms, the connections between, you know, racism in American legal history, how that links up with causes around the world for liberation and freedom in a post-colonial era. And really the work that I've done in those classrooms with students from all around the world, you know, teaching at San Francisco, you got first and second generation immigrant communities. You've got just, you know, a diverse community of native San Franciscans. And we come together across our lines of real and perceived difference. And we're trying to study, you know, these cases. We're looking at all kinds of different things over our history, looking at policies, including affirmative action, including, you know, racial justice initiatives, reparations claims today. But also putting it in a broader historical context that gets us looking at the history of segregation and before that, the history of slavery, and interspersed in that, the the legacies of the Civil War and the Reconstruction period and all the ways that that history is in a certain sense alive in our world today. You know, the history helped shape the communities that we live in, the institutions where we study and work, the disciplines that are given to us, you know, coming down through the generations and building on ways of knowing and perceiving and studying the world that, you know, in a certain sense, can, you know, provide a sort of way in which the past is still present. And so we all kind of know that to live in this world and to think about, you know, questions of justice and injustice and how the law may support us is not, you know, it's never easy for any one of us, whatever our background, right, to be thinking about being in confrontation with these organized, you know, sort of representatives of state power with the authorization to use force against us, right? Anytime we come up in against, you know, that kind of apparatus, it's a challenging moment. And in those classes, we were looking at how different, you know, over the course of American legal history, different over in over generations, different populations of people were not only met with those organized forces and powers, but met in discourses and practices that contributed to the creation of racial hierarchy and, you know, the navigation of this question of rights and responsibilities that were for many, many years infused with the imperatives of white supremacy and imperialism that had a racial tinge in American adventurism around the globe. And so, you know, what we were trying to do in that class is create a space where students could look at that history and learn from it and discern through that experience some of the ways that they could maximize the possibilities for enacting, you know, justice in their work in, you know, right now, today, you know, facing the particular kinds of issues they face today, police brutality, as one example, immigration, and the way in which our discourse around immigration is kind of fused as well with some of these notions about who belongs and who doesn't that have a racial, that have the imprint of our racial history around immigration and naturalization law running through it even today. So it really was about creating a space where students could understand a little bit more how being a lawyer today really invites deepening our understanding of how race and racism continue to confound the possibilities that our system of law, at least ideally, and we recognize it doesn't always work in ideal ways, but ideally it is an important pillar in this, you know, experiment with multiracial, multicultural democracy under a rule of law that we're trying to uphold even against all kinds of onslaughts against it. You know, whether we're talking about, you know, the rise of corporate power, you know, fascism, all these sorts of things. So right. I've been teaching these classes where we're trying to get students to sensitize around the possibility if they're already in law or they came to law school to figure out how to make the best of the knowledge, skills, and values that we train them in this profession. And yet we know that racism still runs through it. How do we make the best of these opportunities in light of that? And I was just seeing my students struggling as we would, you know, go through the course of the materials over time, struggling with how to talk about these issues themselves, how to bring their own inner, you know, experience, their heritages, the particular path that they had walked into the classroom. Some of them were immigrants themselves. Some of them, their family, their you know, last generation, right? Their, you know, very recent history intersecting immigration law and policy. So that was sort of an elephant in the room. Some were not unlike me, having migrated across the country from the southern part of the United States or the Northeast into California, and in the process of that, carrying with them lots of experience of the regional differences around the United States around that impact how we interact across different demographic populations, what we're comfortable with, what we're not comfortable with, what different narratives about who belongs that we've encountered along the way, different ways that our access to resources, including the resources that, you know, enable us to be in higher education in a school like the University of San Francisco, those differential access, the disparity in resources that impacts who can be in those institutional spaces and in those classrooms. Again, another kind of elephant in the room. So I, started to realize that because mindfulness had been an important support for me, for those who haven't seen my photo or don't know, I'm a African-American black woman, or certainly racial. I often use the language of racialized as black to kind of underscore that, in my way of thinking about all of this, race is a feature of our culture in the United States that, is not necessarily a fixed or natural characteristic of human beings, but something that we kind of create.
Right, I'd love to talk about this a little later, but yeah. I'm curious about, so when you're saying you create spaces, right, for your students, What are the qualities of these spaces that you create so there is somewhat of a, can be, I don't know if healing is the right word, but a place of where folks can get in touch with what all these topics bring up for them by themselves and come up with good ideas and solutions how to grapple with it. What are the qualities of these spaces?
Yeah, I tell you, this is a whole work in progress.
Right.
Because, what the qualities were and how to do it, when I was thinking about beginning to write this book, in the mid-2000s or aughts, right? Because I've been teaching these classes. I mean, I first started bringing mindfulness into those classes in like 2004, 2005, so 20 years ago. And then I started, this book comes out in almost 5 years ago now in 2019. It's a changing landscape that we're working with. And what characteristics and qualities, what we're trying to do is create, what I've been trying to do is create a context or a place where, first of all, it's okay and normal for students to recognize that they are not only kind of reading objectively or learning in a sort of objective third person, it's more than just reading what other people say about race and racism, what the Supreme Court says, but recognizing that their own experience matters and creating some space for bringing conversations, stories, telling each other some stories about their own experiences, and making connections between these histories, these cases, these policies that we're reading about in their own stories. So one aspect of it is just, normalizing, creating space to connect the dots between one's personal lived experience and, the sort of issues and concerns being pointed to in the materials that we're reading. So there's a quality of spaciousness that I had to get permission to create by, for example, not including quite as much content of reading and, arguing and writing, literally, slowing down or thinning out a bit some of the content, literally, so you would have more time. In those classroom hours to just pause and not feel like you gotta cram, every single 50 minute hour, if you will, because we usually have a 10 minute break there somewhere with, again, the imperatives of traditional legal education. So implicit in what I'm saying is I bring to bear, I draw on a new way of teaching and learning that also is part of a national movement that is allied with mindfulness, that's called contemplative education, contemplative pedagogy. This way of teaching and learning that recognizes that our first person experience matters. We interweave that with traditional ways of knowing the world, the scientific methods, objective study. But then second person, how we are with each other matters. So creating space to recognize the relationships between us as important, and getting to know each other in those classrooms as not just these fungible, you know, brains who can take tests, but actually human beings with stories. And so all of that, that kind of really changing how we do learning in a higher education, in universities, is kind of part of what we were enacting in those classrooms. So a quality of spaciousness, and then a quality of respect for everybody in the room, that everybody's voice matters. And then inviting, a kind of recognition that there are some sort of opportunities and responsibilities that flow from the qualities that we're in the invitation that we're trying to explore in this kind of space, meaning that it wasn't just about me kind of bringing this approach, but inviting, right, this quality of invitational, let's just use the word co-creation of a kind of space, so that they would feel some responsibility for how we would move this through this material. So we would have a conversation. Sometimes we use the word meta, M-E-T-A, yeah. Like a conversation about the conversation. Like, how do we want to?
More a reflective way and a personal way of learning and exploring. So important in these topics, for sure. Thank you so much, Rhonda, for sharing. Yeah, what you're doing there in the law school. That's amazing. Yeah. So you shared how mindfulness is a huge part, right? The holding to even do that work. Do I get that right? Right?
Yeah.
And how it's supporting.
Part of creating space for us to be able to hold each other and ourselves as we do the work.
Right. And you know, when we think about mindfulness, and you pointed that out in your book so wonderfully as well, is you have the mindfulness part and you have the compassion part, which I think, especially when it's such shaky topics and such topics that can really make us vulnerable and bring up a lot of our personal issues and perhaps shame and guilt and, you know, regret and all these things, and just that self-compassion part, I think, is just a really important piece here. Can you talk a little bit more about the compassion piece in this work?
Yeah. And actually, I'll just say that I had a reader recently tell me that, you know, they were reading my book and they were like, gosh, it feels like the word compassion is so important. Let me pop onto Kindle and do a quick search to see how many times compassion or a version of it is used in the book. And they came back and said, you know, I found that Kindle said it's like more than 700 times in a book of like 300 some pages. So it's on average more than twice per page that we hear compassion or subversion. And, you know, that's intentional, because actually, and I'll just say what I mean by compassion is, you know, it's different from pity. It's distinguishable from empathy, but it's related to empathy. Empathy, that ability to put ourselves in the shoes of another person, to kind of bracket our own particular way of seeing things and imagine the world from the perspective of another. Like, so we can have cognitive empathy, where we imagine what another is thinking, emotional empathy, we imagine what they're feeling. Compassion picks up where empathy can lead us, right? Into, you know, from understanding a little bit more the perspective of another. Compassion is really about the willingness to take action to alleviate that part of another's experience that we can imagine is actually causing some harm. So it's, and this is a way of thinking about compassion that a lot of the research that I lean on for my work also shares, right? We see compassion in particular with this active dimension, this willingness to kind of do something to alleviate harm. And that can be harm. It, you know, the idea of self-compassion begins with taking that willingness to alleviate the harm of suffering and applying that to our own experience with love, with care, with kindness directed toward ourselves. And it can be, you know, the actions that we take to alleviate our suffering, ours or of another's, can be very subtle. It can be, it includes everything from like pausing and taking a breath to really, you know, extending ourselves in a project or doing some active engagement, creating some policy or program to support, you know, those who are suffering in some way. So every, you know, the whole spectrum of different degrees of compassion seem to matter. And we'll put aside for now the other regarding compassion that is, I think, a driver of the kind of work at the intersection of racism and awareness that I'm pointing to in my book. You know, we're talking now first about self-compassion, how just recognizing that we are struggling to figure out how to move through a world, starting right where we are in 2024, that is shot through with the legacies of the world we weren't here for, that we didn't create, but that is, you know, kind of the ground on which we stand, as I pointed to before. We are struggling in all our different ways and our different identities to figure out how to connect, how to survive. Like, we're all going up against a lot right now. You know, we've got these interlocking challenges and crises around climate, the AI revolution. I've alluded to before to the political power dynamics that are kind of pressing in on all of us in different ways, and war making. So, and I'm just pointing to a few people could point to income inequality. I mean, you know, the militarized policing state that we're all up against. So there's just a lot that we're up against.
A lot, yes.
Exactly. And most of us, you know, are struggling with some version of that. And in addition, we are met in a world where, you know, the effort to contribute to a way of being with each other that is infused with notions of differential human worth. Some people matter more than others. Like, that is something that we were born into a world that, you know, was running a bunch of projects and really many different ways. So now when I talk in this way, I'm inviting the kind of interdisciplinary lens, right? I studied sociology at the graduate level before going into law. But the way I talk about this invites, you know, what we know about anthropology, how we as human beings move through and, you know, navigate a world of resources that are not unlimited. Right. The narratives of scarcity are not necessarily as true as we are given to believe that they are. But in some sense, we know we're moving through a social world and challenge to figure out how to get enough resources for ourselves, et cetera. And we know that as part of the world that we live in, you know, stories about who matters, who belongs, who should get what resources, who should be in leadership, who should be doing what, are running, you know, they've been part of what we've been sort of raised up in. And in the course of that, some of us have been wounded. Some of us have met racism in the world, or some, you know, most of us, again, enter into conversations about these things with a whole history that has been more or less consciously infused with opportunities to learn about the racial aspect of the environment that we're living in. In other words, you know, race matters to all of us, but we're not all equally kind of situated to learn about the histories of race and racism, to be met on a daily basis with reminders that race matters. Because if you're in a majority, if you're in a space where you are, and this is so, you know, in many different cultures, sociologists will tell us, like, that the idea of categorizing human beings and then, you know, ranking them is something that's pretty prevalent across different cultures. The specific content of those categories varies. So race is a big thing in a place like the United States. It may not be as big a thing, for example, in Rwanda, but some other categories stand in for the separation and the ranking and the ordering, right? That can lead to a similar outcome, us versus them, and you know the consequent maldistribution of the resources for thriving that we associate with what's called social injustice. Because whenever we're talking about injustice, we're talking about like pointing toward like unfairness in the distribution of resources, whether it be just basic things like enough, you know, opportunities for money, work, education, healthcare, you know, disproportionate contact with policing and the negative consequences that come from that. So racism then, you know, is a term many of us use for really a really dynamic set of processes that combine to reinforce those hierarchies that are emerging in our cultures that are about notions of race and notions of, you know, some racialized beings being more deserving of privileged resources and opportunities than others. And usually there's some hierarchy around race. And in countries like the United States where, you know, white racialized bodies have been privileged since the founding. And certainly, and I say that because, you know, if you look at American history and you look at the period immediately following the foundation of this country as a constitutional democracy. So 1787, 88, 89, we were having our constitutional convention, enacting our constitution for the first time. Very soon after that, 1790, the United States Congress enacted its first naturalization law under which you could become a U.S. citizen. And in that first law, citizenship, naturalized citizenship was restricted to those who were racialized as white. So from the beginning, whiteness has been a category that the law was involved in policing, constructing, infusing with this notion of rights being secured by those who were racialized and deemed white and denied to those who were not. And then it continued through, right, through the whole history of slavery and segregation, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's, when we think about racism, we're thinking about the legacies of that long structured in history of oppression and its consequences.
What strikes me, and it might sound really naive, but it's like what strikes me so incredibly about all these things is the construct of it. The that just a few people, let's say, make the rules. And it doesn't make any sense for the white coming to this country and saying the white are superior. Like, wait, what? Who was here first? Like, who was having a culture first? Who was cultivating the land first? All of these things is just like, for me, when I look at it, it just doesn't make any humane sense. So that's like where I'm get thrown in so often, where I'm like, and then we have the idea, right? That power struggle of, yeah, some people are just going to make the rules for themselves that they work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, right. So, when you think about, there's so many different ways that we have been given to think about race. And so part of the work, I think, is becoming more conscious of some of the obvious and not obvious, right? The more or less obvious, the more or less explicit, sometimes deeply implicit, almost unconscious, ways that we have given to kind of make sense of race in the world. You know, so for some of us, for example, we may have never really had a course where someone explicitly taught us how to think about race. But even if we haven't, we've somehow moved through the world in which we've just sort of received some teachings about it. And so a big part of the kind of work that I do is creating space for just pausing and reflecting. How did we come to know, you know, come to the way we think about race and racism?
And
pausing,
You know, I love that about in the book, that you're not just basically lecturing, you're not just educating, you're very much encouraging, you know, after a few pages, just to pause and ask these wonderful question of like, what a race am I? Like, what a race am I? Like, mm-hmm. I have been asked this before, and I actually had a period where I wouldn't even identify as white. Mm-hmm. And now I'm kind of go back. It's like, no, I am white. Like that kind of thing. But I think this whole idea, as you said, like, what's my identification? Where does that come from? What's my history? What's my name, right? All of these things matter. And when we can start contemplating, like with your encouragement in the book, and really pause and go into these questions, I learned so much, like just following these things. And it's not been my first roller coaster, but it's hopefully not my last, obviously, like, but yeah. Really like bringing that up.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
So I think we actually have a caller here, and I didn't even invite anybody to call. Well, that's even better. People know the rules. And caller, you on the air.
Thank you. This is Anna. And the history I'm reading right now has brought home how deeply the white race was fascinated with its Aryan destiny. And we think of the Aryan Brotherhood and the Ku Klux Klan, but what I'm reading now is the whole mythology of the white race is coming out of the German forests and going west and civilizing as it went, but because of its organized government structure. And right now I'm reading about the 1800s, and many of us have heard of manifest destiny, and we think of the Constitution, and we think of the interests of the slaveholders in writing it. But it's much, as you're explaining, it's much deeper. It was a cultural, common, broadly assumed attribute of the white Aryan race that we were superior, and that the, in a way that created all these structures. And it continues to hit me as a white person. It's like learning the word love over and over as you get older, its meaning changes. And thank you for the work you're doing, because it's just completely beyond me to understand on an intuitive level this whole society that I'm in. I keep thinking it's not as bad as that, and then I keep finding out, oh, it really is. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, caller.
Thank you. Really appreciate your reflections there, Anna. I mean, it's, you know, if you turn toward, if you're willing to pause, as we're saying here, and invite first reflection on our own experience and the way we've been alluding to here. In the book I talk about, for example, we tell stories. If we don't mention the name of the race of the parties involved in the stories, pause and ask yourself, have you filled in the blank? Have you made assumptions about the race of the parties in the story that you've heard? In other words, something in the story might have led you to presumptions or assumptions about the race of those whose races are unnamed. What are the cues that lead us to, again, filling in the blanks? That gives us a kind of a tether to, or an invitation to look more deeply at the way we participate as well in creating these notions of race and in moving through the world with our actions and our assumptions in some way colored by these trainings that we're all imbibing in ways that are, again, often not so obvious, but nevertheless, if we, you know, really look at it, we can find evidence of it. And so another way of opening the aperture or the window on these aspects of our experience and our impact in our world, and that is to, you know, we've talked about just reflecting on experience. Here she's saying, read, right? Actually be open to learning, and then really thinking about what we can learn from studying different aspects of history that, again, often haven't been taught. We've often not been exposed to some of the strands of the history that are relevant here. And there is so much that's interesting about the strands of history that are relevant to the construction and cultivation of this notion of whiteness. You know, we could spend quite a lot of time just focused on that. But I was very interested to read years ago when I was studying some of the legal documents and history around the creation of whiteness, to find, for example, that Ben Franklin, I mean, the caller was talking about the notions of the Germanic kind of Aryan conceptualization, construction of whiteness and white superiority. But by contrast, Benjamin Franklin is on record in the 1700s expressing a view that Germans weren't white enough. In fact, the English and the British were like the true white people.
Well, again, so, that served him, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's always self-serving, isn't it? I mean, you know, all of these notions turn out to be, right, like bubbles. I mean, this is where mindfulness comes in. The way that our conversation might really be distinguished from other conversations about these topics is when we pause and bring in the mindfulness. When we recognize that what mindfulness is helping us to see that is that, you know, all of our world is infused with our constructions and the way that we move through the world, variously provoked by the temptation to cling and attach to that which makes us feel good, to push away that which makes us feel distressed, or to just stay in a fog of unknowing and confusion.
Right.
Right. These are the three poisons that are at the heart and soul, if you will, of the teachings of the historical figure we know of as the Buddha, whose work we translated into mindfulness. Right.
So we have two callers, actually.
Let's bring the callers in.
That's so incredible.
Whenever we're talking about these constructions, we can get quite fixed if we're talking about them through kind of a traditional social justice or didactic lens. Bring in a little bit of mindfulness and we begin to see, oh, yes. Yes, we have self-serving notions about race and identity because that's a way of attaching to this idea in the world in a way that feels good. It can feel good to be a part of a dominant group or a group that's a tribe with a story that gives us a sense that our lives matter. And so really, you know, kind of being more present to the ways that we're seduced into creating these categories again in our own lifetime. And, you know, borrowing from history and keeping them alive today, this is where mindfulness is really inviting us into these conversations in a bit of a different way.
Right. And making it even possible to change those habits and those neurological hardwirings, right, that we all have. Yes. So it's really, I've been exploring. I feel like for me with mindfulness, I can get in a way deeper level of first connecting with a topic and issue, especially if it's uncomfortable. And then also feeling physically like what is happening with me. I think, and I'm really appreciating that you write this in your body, in your book too, right? That the body awareness is so important because the body doesn't lie. And when I have an encounter with somebody who doesn't look like me or doesn't believe like me, what is it triggering in my physical body? I feel like that's for me almost the fastest way to get to the truth and then also be able to unwrap the habit.
Right. And I have to say, this is where for me, you know, humility comes in because, you know, what we're turning toward now is sort of inviting. Again, bringing in the sort of embodied awareness practice of mindfulness to notice, even for those who are listening in, really just to invite, as we notice our energy around this topic, what is coming up for you? What particular thoughts? And beneath the thoughts, what sensations in the body, right? Is there tension? Is there anxiousness? Is there a kind of an emotion that you would attach to those, to some of the sensations and or the thoughts? So in mindfulness, we're often inviting a kind of a opening up of the observational, perceptive, you know, awareness, if you will, so that we can notice thoughts, emotions, and sensations and notice the feeling tones associated with them. Are they pleasant? Are they unpleasant, neutral? And therefore, are we tempted to get kind of seized and stuck? Or, you know, are we tempted to turn off the conversation because, you know, saying some things are coming up we don't like? This is a topic we don't feel, right, drawn to. Or, you know, are we willing to just let this pass over us as if maybe it has nothing to do with me? I'll say that, you know, in my experience, bringing mindfulness in, we really can start to engage more consciously as opposed to being on automatic pilot around these topics.
Right. Thanks. Yeah, I do think we have a caller. Let's give it a try.
Hi, is it me?
Yeah, it's you. Welcome to the show.
Okay, super. I was just wanting to appreciate the previous caller. I feel like these are words of wisdom. And number one, before appreciating the previous caller, I wanted to appreciate you hosting the show on KMUD right now, because I feel like I listen on Sundays, and it's been a long time since I've heard a diverse women's voice, and I feel that this is a great platform. However, I think that the question of identity above and beyond mindfulness is very important, including cultural identity. I would believe that one must, in fact, embrace the history, but also look at the current moment in a struggle that is real, that is, in fact, based on inclusion. Mindfulness is great, and that's superb. However, it wouldn't be bad to continue to focus on what the hosts are discussing, which is who belongs and who does not on this continent. That's my message.
Thank you, caller. Yeah, Rhonda.
And I really appreciate...
Go ahead. Oh, I think we just lost her. But thank you. Thank you so much, caller, for calling in and sharing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if I wasn't quite sure. I had I was curious to hear a little bit more from the caller, because I wasn't quite sure what exactly she was pointing to in terms of what the host was discussing in terms of who belongs and who doesn't. I think she was saying what you were saying, Serena, about how you came to this country and you're like, this doesn't make sense. How is this a country in which whites are privileged? Even though, who was here first, who, I think that's what she was pointing to. Yeah.
I'm not sure. I wasn't sure either, but yeah. But yeah. I think that the whole question of belonging, you know, is actually a really good one.
Yeah.
Can we belong with each other without, like, what you wrote in your book, and you actually also brought it up today a lot, is that creating safe spaces. I think that's a really important part, right? So we can't belong if there's no safe space. However, when I feel like there's a safe space created and I can hold myself and I'm held in a group, then there is way more possible for my system to accept and to open up to. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And I think that's what I would love to see, that we're for each other creating more spaces. And there is this mindfulness part of where we practice together, as you so much also, you know, what I also love what you kind of mentioned in the book is like so important. And mindfulness is not just for myself, my own little thing here. It's so much bigger. Yeah.
I mean, it really is about figuring out how to be together on this one planet where absolutely everything is connected.
And we're all really the same if we look at it.
Right.
And
I mean,
we're not.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So having ability to be together with multiple complex reality, with the kind of truth claims of those who feel aggrieved about the history that we're up against in this kind of in these places and spaces where colonialism has constructed the world and left people who were traditionally the stewards of what we now call San Francisco, what we call Humboldt, etc., bereft of a sense of belonging. Right. I mean, this is the world we live in, where we inhabit spaces that had been stewarded for generations and generations and generations before by people who then were dispossessed of those lands. So there are some truth and justice claims that are part of the background that we are up against. And then the question, so part of my work as a law professor, of course, is a great space for being able to discern how to respond to those claims. And the role of mindfulness then is not to sort of bypass or pacify us out of the effort to discern ways of responding to justice and equity claims as they emerge, it really is about helping us avoid the traps that are always laying in wait for us to kind of reinforce the narratives of us and them and grievance, because something about this time seems to be calling for a kind of a sort of an advance in human capacity to live together on a planet where everything is connected, where absolutely every one of us comes from a group where we could claim some long history, right, of grievance. So the question is, and we see this happening all, we see it driving wars in the Middle East, policy, immigration policies here and abroad. We have to find a way to both recognize our differences and the claims for justice in the face of grievances that are presented, but at the same time to be cultivating our ability to see ourselves as one human family.
Yes.
That multiple complexity as opposed to the binary. It's either us versus them or it's we're all one. It's both. And mindfulness is one of the technologies that I believe can help us hold that kind of complexity.
Yes, absolutely. Both and. It's not but. It's both and. All is true. I mean, yeah, both is, we're holding both and we're living both, right? It's possible. Yeah. We have a couple callers. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, welcome to the show.
I've been hearing the whole conversation with you folks, and it's really fabulous. I'm going to give you a unique perspective. I'm a gay man. I'm in my sixth decade of life, and I'm very vibrant. I'm in the flow. I've really gotten myself into the flow, which is, for me, a major accomplishment. It's taken me about 15 years to do that. As a result of that, my sister, who I, 15 years ago, I didn't fairly get in touch with, didn't really, we were not connecting at all, and now we're totally in the flow with one another. And I attribute a lot of this to, I didn't grow up in America, I grew up in Europe. I grew up in England, and a very young age. And I got a chance to go on that European vacation, and I got a chance to, the final country we were in was Norway. Well, my father was an alcoholic. He was a senior pilot. He was of advanced rank. He was a colonel. He had a lot of responsibilities. And as a result, I was the kid that was seen and not heard. And then I got off the dock, onto the dock in Oslo, Norway, and met my grandfather, who'd been in the resistance in World War II and all that. But he was the most kind, empathetic, confident, sweet human being on the planet. And you look at him and he was almost like a blue, white, translucent being of love. And I was transformed in an instant. I plan on immigrating back to Norway in a couple of years with the sole intention of not only getting a university education, but also to bring back those confident, empathetic type of personalities that these Norwegians have, and reconnecting to family that lives in Norway today.
Thanks, caller, for sharing. Yeah, I mean, when we're touching on, you know, inclusiveness, then we're going definitely, we're opening up to a lot of different things, right? Like, yeah, go ahead, Wanda.
Yeah, and I mean, we do live in this cosmopolitan, I'm going to use an old-fashioned last century word to point to what I hear the caller pointing to. I mean, so we can have a conversation that's big enough to hold it all, to hold the claims of like justice and aggrievement and grievance for those who feel dispossessed, who feel, you know, that we haven't honored and properly met the claims for reparation, for repair, for justice of those who've been harmed over the course of our nation building projects, right, by which we created the states and the state and the land here. And we have we benefited by the kind of urbanizing, multicultural community building that American sort of dreams of democracy have inspired in many places in this country. And that I hear implicit in what the caller is saying about, you know, traveling around the world, going to Norway, maybe coming back. In other words, there's this broad arc of intercultural, interracial contact that is also part of the reality. And so the question is, how can we not only talk about what we are against, more, you know, anti-racism, we're against racism, we're against, you know, anti-oppression, we're against oppression, we want to meet them with equity and justice, but also talk about what we're for. We're for ways of building, you know, resource strengthening bonds across lines of real and perceived difference. They exist around us. They're part of what is going on in all our communities. Like we are, in fact, we like to talk about race as if we're in, and ethnicity as if we're like in these absolutist boxes. But actually, all of us are all already 100% infused. I mean, you cannot live in the United States without having been infused by each other's otherness in a certain kind of way. So we want to both create the spaces for justice around the claims that need to be made and the right doing that needs to be done in the face of too much history of wrongdoing, and to celebrate what it means to be alive together. And I don't mean in a surfacey, BS-y kind of way where we're just eating each other's food and dancing. No, I'm saying to really recognize that we have been formed through multiculturalism. We have ethical sensibilities about justice and human rights that the rest of the world sometimes looks to us to help them export, that come from the fact that we have not only been aggrieved by each other, but we've also learned how to work together across difference. That is something the world needs to hear more about.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, what are we nurturing here? We have two more callers. Caller, welcome to Mindful Mud.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, this is Dan, and I'm really enjoying this conversation. I love the part you're talking about, the mindfulness and really interesting dynamic of having the next caller come on and talk about all the diversity going on in the world and the polarities going on in the world. And it seems like the mindfulness that you're talking about is the only answer to all the divisions that we have. And it seems like, what do they say? When the pawns on the chessboard are fighting amongst one another about what's right, the kings and the queens and the rooks and the bishops, they're partying and drinking champagne and having the greatest time as long as we're fighting with each other about what's right and what's wrong and who deserves an appropriation and who's been victimized and all that stuff. And you're coming out with this concept of mindfulness, and it's really like an outside of time concept where you're stepping outside of time and space reality, and you're going into a place where there's peace and tranquility and where things aren't dying in that moment because you're being in that moment right there and then right now. And that's where I think that the wisdom lies and the answer lies. And you can see that the fractionization of the society is really the plan to demise the society and to keep us powerless by keeping us arguing amongst each other. So God bless you for having a conversation about mindfulness.
Thank you, Dan, for calling in.
Yeah, I, you know, absolutely appreciate this. It's not easy to really step into a sense of possibility around all of these themes because, you know, again, there is so much in the direction of polarizing discourse. There's so much to be, so much sort of political gain or, you know, effort. You know, race and racism, oppressions work because we can be seduced into colluding, right? Doing things that perpetuate, right, the squabbling, the separation, the divisions, and therefore maintain, actually unintentionally often, the hierarchies. In other words, we can, if we're not careful, just find ourselves repeating the same old battles. So one of the things that I hear in this caller's comments is that, yeah, I and it resonates with me that what we're what we're inviting here is recognizing that all of us have this short period of time that we're alive, and we all have innate power to have an impact on the world. And yes, history is relevant and matters, but what is possible in the future depends on how we are today. And so claiming the power that we have that is, you know, not limited to the way other people treat us or what has happened in the past, but we all have power right here, right now. And oppression, the way oppression works is it often makes it hard for us to remember, or, you know, it disconnects us from the sense that we have power to make a difference going forward. And, you know, mindfulness wakes us up to the fact that we just have this limited life, as far as we know, this one precious life. It could end at any time. How do I want to be in relationship to the possibility that that this moment and the next is new in nature? How do I want to impact that and bring forth something that hasn't been given to me or that I haven't received necessarily, but I can offer because it responds to the calling of my sense of what is real now? And so that is, you know, that is, I think, how I hear what the caller is saying. That field of possibility is what mindfulness can open up, not bypassing all of the pain and suffering, but saying we're gonna turn toward that with the vigorous kind of commitment to not missing the possibility that is also here.
Yeah, and for me, it creates so much creativity. You know, I get informed by what I'm suffering from, and then I want to move towards, not more suffering, but I want to move towards, like, changing that into something different. And we have another caller.
Great.
Oh, hello?
Again. Hello?
Hi.
Am I on the air?
You are.
Oh, perfect. Okay. I just think that your conversation is fantastic. And I would like to continue to encourage everybody that is observing KMED right now to donate. And I can only just praise the pragmatism of this conversation, including the positive moves forward without neglecting the pragmatism that is inclusive in maybe not being on the defensive, you know, in terms of injustice. There will be that, you know, we can embrace that injustice is normal and we should just be mindful and everybody will get along. However, there does continue to be a struggle, which I feel like the host, I haven't been listening the whole time because I'm on the road, but I feel like the guests on the show are pointing out some really realistic points of view in terms of just equality. And the one comment that I had was that although mindfulness and et cetera, and defensiveness, the only way that we can solve injustice is to be peaceful and, you know, inclusive, et cetera. But there do come moments when one needs to continue to point out these things, especially Absolutely. From a legal point of view, which is why I really continue to encourage KMED to host professionals and mindful, et cetera, endlessly diverse perspectives so that we can continue this conversation, because I believe that the North Coast is a hub for expansive thinking. However, we are sitting upon native land and a certain kind of economy that has transformed and has created an entire dichotomy of inequality that is just a reproduction of the outside world in a microcosm, and that is really worth looking at. And I think that some of the elders have a lot to say, but I also think that the young voices need to be heard.
Yeah.
And therefore, again, KMUD is the absolute best resource for this. And we cannot let this die because it is actually the one thing about Southern Humboldt County that matters.
in my belief.
That's a big statement, but thank you so much.
Continue for it.
That's fantastic.
I love you guys. Well done.
Thank you so much for calling in. And I am here on Mindful Mutt with Rhonda V. McGee, author of The Internal Work of Racial Justice, Healing Ourselves and Transforming Our Communities Through Mindfulness. Yeah, did you want to
remember that second part is real?
Yes.
Transforming our communities. I think whenever you say mindfulness and you actually want to practice it and pause, as we've been doing in this conversation, it's some people can be triggered into thinking that we're really trying to bypass or pacify or take us away from the act. Work of transforming the world in the direction of justice. None of that can be farther from the truth for me. Like, I wouldn't be
same here.
Right, right. We wouldn't be here in this conversation if it weren't for us being allied in the sense of the urgent need to create a world that works better for all of us. I've spent 20 some years as a law professor supporting folks and going out and bringing the actions and doing the things that we need to do to transform the world. But the impetus to bring in mindfulness comes about because it's not lost on most of us that the system that we are promulgating is, you know, perpetuating harm in and of itself in some ways. That is to say that, this legal system embeds in it injustice and can create harm and does often create harm in its normal operation, in the particular ways that it runs the adversarial model and reinforces the notion of separate, isolated individuals with rights and responsibilities that don't well apprehend collective interest and common good. So thank goodness we have the legal system, but we need more. We need, the vision of every generation, younger, medium, older, and beyond. We need everybody. This is an all hands on deck moment in human history and in world history. There is no effort in this conversation to privilege any particular one point of view, but it is to say that there's a dimension of the work that is about consciousness raising, because we cannot kind of create a future beyond what we already live in if we only are drawing on, the vision that we've received from others. And so it's hard to create a new vision if you don't stop and recognize some of the ways that your current vision has been formed by miseducation, by all of the dynamics of capitalism and imperialism and all the things that we find objectionable. It is easier said than done to actually create a vision for the future that is not in some ways beholden to the past. And so that's what I think, that's the part of the conversation. And I'll just say, some of what my work is informed by conversations amongst the indigenous here in San Francisco, the Ohlone Rimatesh tribelet of members who will say, yes, we no longer have significant land holdings in San Francisco. No, we don't have a vision necessarily that we'll rematriate the land. Like, what we are arguing for now is co-stewardship. We recognize that we now are, the question is, what do we want to do now with this land in recognition, yes, of the painful, unjust history, but of also the fact that, there are people living on this land now, diverse groups of people. How do we work together from here is an important question for a lot of people. So yes, bring in all of the voices, but know that the question of how to envision a new world is one that's open to many, many different creative ways of being alive together.
One of the things that has been coming to me, I'm like, why is it so uncomfortable, really? I mean, there are many aspects. Why is it uncomfortable to really tackle this topic and really be with it? And part of it is because it's not a quick fix. It's like we have to be clear that this is centuries, decades to come, because it's been so long in the making and it's so embodied and it's so ingrained. It's so in everything, really, in every way we're living. And so just that alone can be so discouraging. It's like, oh, God, we can't really fix this right now. And then,
right.
yeah. Go ahead.
And it interrs, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh, a teacher from the Vietnamese Zen tradition, you know, uses this term interbeing. Whenever we're talking about race, it's just an aspect of all of the different interlocking challenges that we're up against. Yes, this economic system needs to change, but really fundamentally, how we see ourselves, whether we see ourselves as separate, isolated individuals, which has, you know, an important legacy and the kind of a post-Enlightenment effort to fend off the injustices of feudalism, right? There's a reason why we think of ourselves in these individualized, as these, you know, separate identities. And the question is, have we, you know, kind of overcommitted to this notion of separate hyper-individualism so that it's really, really hard for us to envision the both and of being separate and also being alive together? And we don't have, you know, I'm here to tell you, as a person who is taught law, graduate degree in sociology, done a lot of different things, we don't actually have the language even that we need, I think, to enact the new world that we feel wants to be born in the wake of the destruction and the devolutions of capitalism that we know is not working, of militarism and adventurism that we know is just causing more climate distress and actual real world unnecessary suffering. We have to find new ways. And I think the invitation for bringing mindfulness in is about transforming how we see the nature of who we are and the problems we face so that we can work, you know, creatively toward this new world, but do so in a way that isn't, you know, bound to fail because it's too caught up in the way we think of ourselves that we've inherited from the past.
Yeah. Wow. You know, it's time is flying. We're coming to the end here. But I would like to share before, you know, I want to invite you to share some last words, but I would like to share a quote of your book. When we practice deconstructing race and racism, we practice deconstructing separation. We are practicing the healing power of interconnection and the transformative power of true freedom. So, yeah, what are your last words, Rhonda? What do you want to share with the listeners as your last little thing? And also, how can people get in touch with you and your work that you're creating?
Thank you so much. You know, I just really feel honored to be in this conversation with you, my dear Florina, and this community here, this KMUD and beyond community. So just grateful. And just to say, yes, people can contact me and stay in touch at rhondavmcgee.com. You know, I'm giving a talk tomorrow that is about women in, you know, in these conversations about inner work. But I just feel like we, as humankind, we are being, I think, called to turn toward rather than away from all of the suffering that we see here at home and abroad and, you know, at the farthest corners of the globe and at every point in between. We can see each other's lives more clearly today than we ever could. And the question is, what will we do in response to the suffering in our midst? And I'm here with you to hold hands to make it a better world for all of us. And I think we can do it. So thank you for doing your part, my dear.
Thank you so much, Rhonda. What a pleasure. What a gift you are for the world and for sharing this here at this radio station. So, so grateful. So this conversation of Mindful What was with Rhonda V. McGee, author and best-selling author of The Inner Work of Racial Justice, Healing Ourselves and Transforming Our Communities Through Mindfulness. Excellent book.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast and also on our website, kmud.org.